faith is about the mystery and the majesty and the mercy of God, where we cannot help but be humble before him and be humble before others made in his image, even if they do not believe in his existence.
We live in an interconnected world where the questions are complex, and so we have Babel Undone. And it exists to have a conversation about issues of interest to all of us, or maybe things that make you a little curious. I'm Johnny Moore, an American evangelical leader who serves as the president of the Congress of Christian Leaders. And I want to welcome you to Premier Christian Radio's Babel Undone podcast featuring Archbishop Joseph D'Souza.
Bishop, what are we speaking about today?
We are looking at the theme of how do we maintain a civil society, which is one of the critical challenges of our time, when society is now anything but civil in many parts of the world, with such a lot of hate, division, and misunderstanding, and people attacking and marching on the streets, etc.
And our guest this morning for that conversation, Bishop, is someone that you and I know quite well. He's, aside from being a former U.S. Marine infantry officer, and holding all kinds of different titles and positions, including at the Love Your Neighbor community and the Haifa Laboratory for Religious Studies, and teaching in the University of Washington's Comparative Religion Program. He is one of the leading experts on what he has termed covenant pluralism, right? The ability of people of all kinds of different backgrounds, faiths, to live together in a way that contributes meaningfully to society. And by the way, it's not just Chris Seipel in his own career, you know, that has contributed to this conversation. Dr. Seipel's father was the first U.S. ambassador for international religious freedom, a former chief executive of World Vision. It runs in the Seipel blood to make a difference in the world. And he joins us now.
So, Chris, Johnny and I both know you, and we've been following your work and, of course, applaud what you've been able to do. Many of our listeners who are actually all over the place in many parts of the world would not know about Chris Seipel. They probably would, some of them know that your father was the first religious commission ambassador. But if for the sake of our listeners and audience, if I were to ask the question, who is Chris Seipel, what would you tell us about yourself?
Well, thank you for this existential question. I think, look, I'm a guy who tries to know Jesus a little better today than I did yesterday, and
bless you.
Sometimes I'm successful. I'm a guy that believes in his church, that his church is called to action, that it is anchored in eternity and transcends time and space with like an army with banners terrible unfurled. That's a paraphrase of C.S. Lewis as Screwtape.
Yeah.
Quoting Song of Solomon. I also am a guy who served in the Marine Corps for 9 years, an infantry officer. I want to walk the ground in the cold light of day, get from A to B in a manner that glorifies God. And I'm someone who's worked in the NGO world for quite some time. So I've got these hard power and soft power voices I hear in my head. And trying to operate at the intersection in a manner that stewards my kingdom citizenship, my global citizenship, and my national citizenship, all of which are gifts from God.
You know, being in this conversation with Dr. Chris Seipel and Archbishop Joseph D'Souza is a personally meaningful thing for me, because the two of you have each in totally, totally different ways, but as impactfully been mentors and teachers to me. And there's so much about the difference I want to make in the world myself that I feel called to do, where the inspiration and the tools, you know, have come from the two of you. We often use vocabulary, though, that I think, you know, a lot of regular folk, you know, who don't live in the world that we live in, of advocating for religious freedom and, traveling all around the world, trying to move the needle a little bit, or at least make sure it doesn't go back too far. There are terms everyone hears, but they don't know what they mean. And I think, Chris, you could really, really help us and help a lot of our listeners who are, just starting to pay attention to these things with understanding one term almost more than anyone, which is civil society. I mean, this term seems vague, it seems lofty. What does it actually mean, and what does it mean to you?
Yeah, thanks. Great question. I probably should have included in my self-description that as the president of the Institute for Global Engagement, which my dad and mom founded based on his experiences at the State Department, with which he was frustrated sometimes because they couldn't move as fast as he would like to, as a former Marine himself, they created the Institute for Global Engagement. And so I had an opportunity to witness civil society, quote unquote, in China, Vietnam, Laos, Myanmar, Iraq, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, North Africa, Tunisia, lots of different places, and in some places, Pakistan have programs. In some places, they were successful, some places, they weren't. So here's what I think. I think civil society, if you take it at face value, exists everywhere. I get irritated when people in the so-called West tell people in the majority world their society is not civil because you don't have enough NGOs that do things the way we do it, or XYZ. You don't have democracy like we do. But civil society is always a function of the people who live there and usually the beliefs that they have. So, how do we work toward the common good? That's not a phrase maybe the majority world would use as much as the quote Western world, but how do we serve everybody? How do we serve our neighbor? And how do we do so as a function of having integrity with our own beliefs and yet respecting the beliefs of the other without demonizing them? Because it's tough to have civil society sometimes when we have a global phenomenon of religious nationalism, which will take an ethno-religious majority, try and preserve its place in society and state, and demonize minorities, ethnic and religious minorities to maintain their power. So it really depends on the local context, but I always believe that civil society is at its best is according to the values of the people who live there, and that is the best deterrent against extremism of any kind, to include religious nationalism, to include those that become terrorists.
Fascinating. And where do you think this engagement with civil society that you and your father and all embarked on has brought you? How do you read? Because we have seen in recent years in the majority world and other places, civil society itself in different nations coming apart. Because of largely political and religious leaders, but also I think the economic stakeholders exploiting this divisions to enrich themselves or to make to see how all of this can go to create better business monopolies and all. So where has it taken you, and how do you see it is placed, and how do you, and I as an outsider want to at least have a comment or two from you about the state of civil society in the U.S.
Well, that's a great question. And that brings another word into the conversation, which is the word pluralism. And pluralism is a word that has many meanings. And in some places, it's not a good meaning because pluralism, like the term, and I'm going to be a little glib here, but just to illustrate the point, the term pluralism, like the term interfaith, can mean everybody have a group hug and go find a tree, hug that tree, and then nothing happens. It's just a photo op. And there's a great danger in what I would call interfaithism, which is what that is. I believe in a multi-faith approach where people bring the best of their values of their faith to the table, public policy or society, and respect the beliefs of others without imposing them on others. We want to propose, not impose. So I, and that's, by the way, how John John Paul II was described as Pope. I'm in Krakow, Poland, where he used to be Archbishop before he became the Pope. And I've been thinking a lot about him and the role of the church here and the defeat of communism. But to your point, well, let me define pluralism and then talk about where it's breaking down. I use pluralism as the engagement of difference. In America, we and don't take me wrong here, but we worship at an altar called diversity. Diversity is, for me, a description of a demographic fact. Diversity is the presence of difference. And humanity is different all over the place. Pluralism is the engagement of difference. Covenantal pluralism, which is a funding initiative that I helped establish at the Templeton Religion Trust, a $2 billion foundation in Nassau, Bahamas. Covenantal pluralism is the positive engagement of difference. And we include others because they bring their beliefs to sit at the public table, the public square. And people don't necessarily agree with the beliefs of the other, the behavior of the other, but we respect the dignity that each human has. Because we believe that dignity comes from God. And even if you're a secular humanist, you believe all humans have dignity. So dignity is an organizing principle for how to do engagement, positive engagement. And a covenantal pluralism is one where I'm obliged to respect and protect the other, especially if I'm the majority culture and there are minorities or non-majorities. Minority is almost a negative term these days. To respect and protect those who are threatened by the majority in this age of religious nationalism, where, as you said, Bishop, they use that to divide society against each other so they can maintain their own power. And we're seeing this in many countries around the world right now.
So you've mentioned the term religion or religious already a few times. It naturally emerges in these discussions. But I'm wondering, Chris, to what extent is, say, the proper use of religion valuable to a functioning society? Because I think very, very often we hear about sort of the worst examples of religion, you know, religion used for political purposes or religion, you know, for various forms of extremism as a tool of division or of bigotry or all of these things. Like, so how important is religion in this conversation? And you know, if you look and say, like, that's how it's supposed to work, what does it look like?
Yeah. Oh, great, great question. Look, let me give you another contrast, like interfaith and multifaith. And again, I'm not trying to be glib, but faith and religion. Religion's a good word. It describes things. John Adams said, without religious people, the Constitution makes no sense. And he's absolutely right. And he's referring to the moral values that come with religion and particularly the majority religious group. But for me, religion sometimes can be used, and for many people who have experienced it, the institutionalization of ideas that prevent the best of progress, women from being in leadership, even if it's not ordained leadership, but regular leadership in society, or I want my religious group to be in power, and so therefore other religious groups. And that eventually leads to the validation of violence. And we've all seen all religions validate violence for its own power. I would say faith is about the mystery and the majesty and the mercy of God, where we cannot help but be humble before him and be humble before others made in his image, even if they do not believe in his existence. So I sometimes like to say only the best of faith defeats the worst of religion. And we want to see this humble faith, this humble theology and presentation of what I believe in interaction with the other and talking about the irreconcilable theological differences while maintaining and discussing the common values. And I think America at its best has always been a pioneer in that. We're seeing that break down a little bit, as the bishop alluded to. And we're seeing it break down in some places of the so-called Christian West, or where Christianity helped develop Europe and other countries. But that is what it is at its best. We're also seeing it raise up in places where maybe you would not expect it. I've spent a lot of time in Central Asia, and we're seeing it begin to develop and emerge there in new and exciting ways according to the local context.
Chris, since Johnny has led us into the issue of religion and religious pluralism, I know you...
Don't blame it on me, Bishop.
you always are there so that I can, make you carry all the blame and I can carry all the credit. No.
That's what it means to be an archbishop.
Yeah. So Chris, I don't know how much you're following our work and my work in the last several years, and I'm writing about it. In this, and related to our experience now in India with the rise of religious nationalism, etc., one of the huge issues is the issue of conversion and how all of the majority religions misread, misunderstand, and basically are opposed to the idea of conversions. Mm-hmm. I have now gone public, and I'm writing, that the Great Commission has been misunderstood by the church. I thank God for all the good that came out of it, but it was never a call to go and convert the world. It was never meant to go and convert the world. It was something else, and of course I've written about it, etc. Within the inter-multi-faith dialogue, I openly say, I'm not here, the church in India is not here to convert India to become a Christian nation, and all of that language, I said, has come from a particular paradigm. And what has happened in Christianity is the Great Commandment trumped, no, the Great Commission has ended
trumped
up...
the Great Commandment.
...has trumped the Great Commandment. And I want to be known, I want the church to be known in India and around the world as a Great Commandment church, not as a Great Commission church. But, there is a huge backlash to that because of the history and the money and everything else involved.
Sure.
In building a civil society and thinking about how God is in the origin of religions and all, to think make everything in black and white doesn't work. To paint Islam as a black thing or to paint Hinduism as a black thing, that's not where the world is today, nor am I today. God is above all of this stuff, and he's allowed all of this to happen. And a multi-faith approaches and what you call the covenant of pluralism surely should lead us to work on this more, don't you think?
And there's also sorry to jump in, Chris, but I also think that there's this like huge misunderstanding that when Christians are trying to be a light to the world, and share our good news or talk about our faith or love the world, that it's a synonym for proselytization, right? And it brings, which is a bad word, that brings in lots and lots of bad examples through history.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with you, Bishop, on the commandment and the commission. And I've often said that if you can't follow the Great Commandment, don't bother with the commission.
Good for you. Good for you, yeah.
Because if you forget the Great Commandment, then you end up proselytizing. And proselytizing has this negative connotation across the world of a quid pro quo. Become a Christian and I'll give you some rice, or I'll help you dig a well or whatever. And that's not the faith. The lectionary, Anglican lectionary reading for this morning was Zacchaeus. Come on down, Zacchaeus. And right away, he's talking to all these people. He's not proselytizing, but he is evangelizing, I think. He's sharing. And I always say that there's another contrast. I don't proselytize, but I evangelize. I evangelize by loving. James 2:18, I will show you my faith by what I do. That's how to operate in this world. We want people to come to know Christ. But if we don't embody the way Christ lived and commanded us to and share those values through our actions, then there's no evidence. And why would anybody want to be a part of that faith? But in a covenantal pluralism context, we have to be careful to say, if you're a Muslim and you do dawah, I invite you to do dawah. But I want you to think about the difference between proselytization and sharing of your faith. Christians and Muslims, 70% of the world by the end of the century, It is part of the DNA to share the faith. Wherever, hopefully it's good DNA. It's good DNA, period. But how it manifests itself, as you've said, the paradigm depends on the paradigm. But we have to allow for the sharing of faith and the hope that we have. I want people to become Christians. I just don't want to proselytize to make them do so.
Excellent point.
When we talk about, though, values like religious freedom and being a responsible citizen and cooperating like across different sectors, the church and other aspects of civil society, even business, government, you know, this can be very idealistic. It's not easy to do in certain contexts. Like, how do you move these things from, you know, lofty ideals to like lived realities as citizens in whatever country in the world that a listener is, you know, listening to us now?
Well, my first rule is never expect, when you're engaging the world, never expect anybody to do the right thing.
That's great.
To say you have to harness their self-interest. And this is not about proselytization. This is about service. So if I want to see the dial move and see more religious freedom in a country, what is it about that government's self-interest and that local society's self-interest that I can serve? And in the transaction of the moment of the self-interest being served and being frank, trust begins to be built. And when trust is built, transformation starts to happen. I'll give you an example. I went to Uzbekistan 25 years ago doing research for my dissertation. I wrote my PhD on U.S.-Uzbek relations. And that country is very different for the positive than it was 25 years ago. I have the great privilege of playing a very, very small part in that because of the types of conferences and meetings and certificate programs that equip citizens top down with the government, bottom up with the grassroots, where you come alongside the best of the culture and the best of the people while serving their self-interest. Every country, like every person, has its own path. And when you tell them what path to take, I think you violate the commandment to love. So when we do conferences around the world, we give them a comparative analysis. We give them examples from different countries. Now you decide what you would like to do. We like this part from the Vietnam model. We like this part from the German Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. Then the progress, quote unquote, takes place. I think there are universal norms and international standards, and they are good. But how you get to them matters. And it has to be in a conversation. One last example about this from the Western world. When World War II ended, French and German historians began to meet to talk about what the history looked like, because winners always write the history. They finished writing a textbook in 2006 because they finally had an agreed-upon narrative. If you can't agree upon the narrative post-conflict or in any situation, then you will have different ways of understanding things, and there will be no progress. So part of what I like to do is come alongside the best of the culture, recover, restore, work with what the reformers or whoever's in power are already doing that resembles the best of the culture and the best of the majority faith. And help them live up to their standards just as they're helping me live up to my standards.
So, Dr. Seifel, we have one last question, and you can feel free to take your time with it. In this crazy, insane, often depressing world that we're living in, what gives you hope?
Well, there's only one reason for my hope, and that is Jesus. So, and in these times of religious nationalism, where we have very clear echoes of the 1930s, and with Christians still being the highest persecuted group in the world, we remember Revelation in this, and that our job is not to run. Our job is to faithfully endure and to testify. So that's the only hope that matters. Now, what about the moment? You can't eat words to live, although we are required to eat the book, and Revelation says that too. But I have hope from a country like Poland, we're in right now. Who would have thought 35 years ago, and I was here as a student, and at the fall of the wall, who would have thought that religion could have played such a role in the fall of communism with Pope
John Paul.
John Paul II, as we discussed earlier? And this total communist state, there was a black market for dollars. There was nothing available for ordinary people. And now it has a better economy than Germany. Now it is supporting Ukraine against the same aggression that it suffered in 1920, 1940, 1939, 1944. And the people have come along. Do they have their own challenges? Of course they do. We all do. But Poland is a great example of how we move forward from a dark past. We're seeing that same example in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. We're seeing it in Vietnam. Is it the way that we are trained to think about it? To Bishop's point about the paradigm, you need to do this, this, and this in your democracy. Not exactly. But they're moving in that direction, and it's according to their own pace and their own people and their own principles. And that's a beautiful thing. And that always gives me hope.
Chris, your work has long made the world a better place. It's a story of global impact and wise leadership. And you've taught us a lot today. Thank you for joining us. Bishop, Chris Seipel is the rare original thinker. I mean, every time he talks, he says something, and I'm like, I haven't quite thought of it that way before. And you know, I just it is such an exceedingly rare thing in our world to talk to someone and hear any original thinking at all. But the depth he brings to these complex parts of the world he just dives into is just so helpful to me, at least.
I think so. I think, and I am also very encouraged that he's on the same page as us in terms of the Grand Commandment should always trump the Great Commission, not the other way around. We have, though it's very important to evangelize, we have messed it up in terms of our communication and, of course, the actions we have taken and everything else. So, and then 2025 is not where the world was after the Second World War. We live in a completely different world where people have access to communication and reports and everything 24/7. And we cannot, and I really, if you want to have peace and we want to have civil society where the people of God can function and carry on their faith and all, we have to strengthen local civil society and help them. The local civil society in Saudi Arabia would be different from what it is in India, but there is good in all civil society, and to encourage them to build their civil society. And ultimately, it's a civil society which will bring the major transformation that is required, not some outside players.
Yeah, I mean that phrase you use, like, look, don't even try to do the Great Commission if you're not already doing the Great Commandment. I was like, that's one I'm writing down, and I think a way of describing so much of what you embody. And the beauty of this conversation and the types of conversations we have on Babylon Done is that we dive into the complex issues, and in this conversation, we left with tools we can use in our diverse societies today.
Yeah, very good.
If you haven't already, please consider subscribing so you always have our most current episodes ready to go. And also, if you wouldn't mind, please take a few seconds to leave a review on Premiere Plus or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It helps us to hear your feedback, and it helps others find us more easily too. And lastly, if you'd like to support the ministry of Babylon Done, you can find a link at the bottom of the show notes where you can support the podcast. Thanks for listening. Thank you for joining us today for Babel Undone. If this conversation had you thinking, then why don't you share it with someone else? For more episodes of Babel Undone or other amazing content that helps Christians live out their faith, you should head over to premier.plus. That's Premier, Premier, for the Americans listening in, dot plus.